Right now, I'm joined on the phone by Barry Bachrach. He's the lead counsel for Leonard Peltier, and he's been involved with Leonard's case for the last 4 years. Hello, Barry.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much, and Leonard, thanks you for giving the opportunity to speak about his case.
Thanks for taking the time to join us today. Why don't we just begin by what the latest news is in Leonard's case. I heard he was just transferred from Leavenworth to Terre Haute, and I also heard that his family wasn't informed of this. Is that true?
Correct. We suspected that he'd be transferred for a while because they changed Leavenworth, but they actually moved him out. I never even found out until a few days after, and his family didn't either. He was just whisked away and brought to Terre Haute. And he's now in the hole at Terre Haute under the guise that they don't have his records. And so we've been asking people, and if you go to the leonardpeltier.org, or .com site, you can see ways in which to communicate with the Bureau of Prisons and the prison itself to express your feelings about this treatment, which we didn't think was correct.
Now, why is he in the hole? Just because he's been transferred, why is
he in
solitary?
Well, they say he's in the hole until they have his records, which raises suspicions in my mind, because it's not hard. If you're transferring someone, you should be able to transfer the records immediately, but he's in the hole apparently awaiting the receipt of the records.
And have you had any communication with him? What is the
Yes,
what's
as
the situation?
Soon as I found out that Friday that he had been moved, because I had no idea, I did speak to him Friday afternoon.
How is he doing?
Well, he's very upset because, you know, he was moved. He was not treated very well. He was put in the hole. He's at a low point. I mean, it's bad enough to be moved, but to be moved under those circumstances and then be put in that kind of situation is very upsetting.
Why was he moved?
Well, they were changing Leavenworth from a maximum security to a lower security, is what we've heard, and they're moving out a number of the prisoners. He's not the only one that I represent that's been moved out.
And by law, don't they have to notify the family if they're going to be moving a prisoner like that?
I don't think they're necessarily required, but you'd think common decency would require someone to notify the family or at least his attorney that he's been moved just in case I need to get a hold of him.
I mean, I heard that his grandson attempted to visit him and was just informed, oh, he's not here.
Right, and that's how I found out. His grandson went to visit him Friday morning and was told he's not here, he's been transferred, and that's when I got a call to let me know that he was transferred. And that's when I immediately then began trying to make contact with him, and I was able to make contact with him by Friday afternoon.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the legal things that have happened in his case. He had a hearing a couple of weeks ago in Fargo, North Dakota. Can you talk about that?
Right. We had a hearing in Fargo on June 15th. The hearing, in a nutshell, challenges the jurisdiction of the court to have convicted him under the statutes that it did. It's fairly technical argument, but the bottom line was, it's our position that the federal government had authority only to charge and try him under the Indian Crimes Act, and it charged him with crimes that we contend the U.S. government has no jurisdiction over the reservations. And we had that argument on June 15th before Judge Erickson in Fargo, North Dakota, and we're awaiting a decision on that.
What do you think the outcome will be? Are you optimistic? And what would be the best possible scenario?
Well, the best possible scenario would be that the judge agrees there was no jurisdiction, and then Leonard would get a new trial, which he would relish, because I don't think there's any way they could prove the case against him, because already after... the government has already admitted, after withheld evidence and new evidence came to light, that it didn't know who shot the agents. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in 1995, at a parole hearing, the assistant U.S. attorney stated that there was the government had insufficient evidence to sustain a conviction that Leonard shot the agents. So the best possible outcome would be that the court finds that he was tried under the wrong statutes and he'd be given a new trial.
So even the FBI admits openly, publicly, that they don't know who shot the FBI agents that Leonard Peltier was convicted of killing?
Oh, absolutely.
How can he still be in prison, then, if they admit that they don't know who was responsible?
Well, they then upheld his... Let me give just a short history to what happened. Was Leonard was tried, and the linchpin of the case that was that he shot the agents, because they tried him as being a cold-blooded murderer, was the link between an AR-15, which is like an M-16, and a casing that was found in one of the agents' trunks a few days after the incident. After the trial, Leonard's defense team sent out Freedom of Information requests, and the government produced evidence which showed that they intentionally withheld evidence and intentionally withheld a test which showed that there was no link between that gun and the casing. And that, in a nutshell, would have that broke the link of Leonard being the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And the government, at oral argument before the Eighth Circuit on several occasions, after the government got caught with that bad act, admitted that it does not know who shot the agents. So then they changed their theory to, well, the conviction can be upheld on aiding and abetting, which carries the same penalty. But no one to date has ever explained how Leonard aided and abetted. They just did a sort of a shell game and upheld the conviction on that other ground.
Mm-hmm. So, Barry, maybe you could give us a little bit of history on this, exactly what the circumstances were surrounding these two FBI agents being shot. It happened on a reservation, isn't that right?
Right. It happened on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which... in 1975. Now, at this time, there was a war. It was really a war going on between the government and the American Indian movement. And the reason that Pine Ridge Indian Reservation became important was because uranium and other valuable minerals that Big Energy wanted were discovered. And during this time period, our government supported a tribal chairman named Dick Wilson, who was a mixed blood, and Mr. Wilson, through monies our government gave him, created his own police force known as the Goons, which is the Guardians of the Oglala Nation. And from 73 to 76, there was what was called the Reign of Terror, where traditional Native Americans were murdered. There's over 60 unsolved murders that were never even looked into. There's many instances of just complete terrorizing of the traditionals. And what happened was the elders and the traditionals called on AIM in early 75 and asked for some protection. And that's how Leonard and several other warriors of the American Indian Movement happened to be on the reservation at that time. And basically they were protecting the elders and also helping the elders maintain the traditions of the Native Americans. And what happened on the date on June 25th, 1976, two FBI agents traveled into the area where Leonard and the other AIM members were camping under the guise of chasing someone who had stolen a pair of cowboy boots.
And they came onto the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
And then a shootout occurred, and two agents died, and a Native American young man, Joe Stuntz, was killed. And what shows me that this was more than just coincidence is that the government had heavy artillery, half-tracks, tanks, et cetera, on the reservation within hours. And so I think it was more than coincidence that this incident happened. I believe that they were baiting, they went in there to bait a shootout, and they miscalculated the firepower that Leonard and others had. And frankly, they wouldn't have known who they were, whether they were FBI agents or goons terrorizing, and they were just there, frankly, to protect themselves and protect the traditionals. And that's really the circumstances. People have to realize that we have an FBI document showing that 2 months before the shootout, it talks about paramilitary operations in Indian country, and that's what was occurring. Our government was conducting military operations in Indian country and supporting a tribal government that was killing and torturing traditional members in order to force them to acquiesce in land sales to big government and other U.S.-owned entities.
What business did these FBI agents have coming onto the reservation? What jurisdiction did they have? Their claim, as you said, was that they were there to investigate a case of some stolen boots.
Stolen cowboy boots.
Uh-huh. So what that... It seems like that's something that would be handled by some type of law enforcement on the reservation. What... Did they have jurisdiction to be coming onto the Pine Ridge Reservation the way they did without... Even announcing that they were there?
It's arguable that they had it. They were the incident that spurred their going on to the reservation was an incident earlier where some Native Americans had beaten up someone and stolen cowboy boots. Their jurisdiction, in my mind, was always questionable, and they claimed to have a warrant to go in, but that warrant never existed until July 7th, 76. So they went on the reservation without a warrant, chasing someone who they thought had stolen cowboy boots. It just doesn't ring right.
And you say there was a shootout. Is there any idea how that started? Did some of the American Indian Movement members think that the FBI agents were there to? I mean, did they think they were goons or what happened?
Well, they didn't. There's varying stories. If you listen to the government, you get a different story. But from what I understand and looking at the history and reading everything, they were chasing a vehicle. The initial reports were, the initial transmissions were that they were chasing a red Jeep. The red Jeep apparently stopped, and people got out of it, and shooting started to occur, which then drew the attention, immediate attention of the people like Leonard and others in the camp, who then came up and they didn't know who or what was shooting because there was so much shooting going on at the reservation at that point in time. They just knew that there were people, families, young children and women who were present and needed protection. So that's what started the the shooting. That red Jeep becomes important because later and at trial, that red Jeep became a red and white van, which was a vehicle supposedly owned by Leonard. But if you read the trial transcript and if you look at the transcripts of the original transmission, the FBI agents were chasing a red Jeep, not a red and white van. And this is some of the misinformation and information that was manipulated in order to convict Leonard.
I see. So, as you mentioned a bit ago, you had a hearing a couple weeks ago in Fargo, North Dakota, and you're hoping, best case scenario, that would result in a new trial for Leonard in which you're confident he would be acquitted. As you said, there's no evidence linking him to the crime. In fact, the FBI admits they don't know who shot the two agents that day.
Exactly. And if you look at, there were four people indicted for the murder. Bob Robideau and Dino Butler and Jimmy Eagle were the other three. Robideau and Butler were tried while Leonard was up in Canada, and they were able to prevail on a self-defense theory because the judge allowed in the evidence of the underlying circumstances and what was facing them, and they were acquitted. Now, when Leonard's trial came up, the FBI, there's an FBI memo that indicated what happened in the first trial and what needed to happen in the second trial. And sure enough, everything that they needed to happen, all this evidence was kept out, and Leonard was virtually unable to raise self-defense.
So had he been able to do that, it's likely that his case could have gone the same way that Robideau and Butler's did.
Yes, if he had a fair trial, I'm sure he would have been acquitted.
So can you tell us, I'll just mention, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. I'm speaking with Barry Bachrach. He's the lead counsel for Leonard Peltier and has been for the last 4 years. We're talking about a number of things, including the fact that Leonard was just moved to Terre Haute from Leavenworth, and there's action. The Leonard Peltier Defense Committee is asking people to take. You can find out more at their website, which is leonardpeltier.com. His last name is spelled P-E-L-T-I-E-R. And so what can you just give us some idea of why you think this case is important? You've mentioned some of the inconsistencies in the case.
Well, I think this case is important because it reflects the injustice that many people, especially Native Americans, get in this country. I'll just quote from a recent decision by the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in November of 2003, when we were challenging Leonard's length of time before he could be considered for parole. And the Tenth Circuit said, quote, "Much of the government conduct on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and in the prosecution of Mr. Peltier is to be condemned. The government withheld evidence, it coerced witnesses. These facts are undisputed. Yet the court did nothing." And this country was founded upon justice for all. And when any person does not receive justice, and when in fact there's indisputable government misconduct that not only the Tenth Circuit recognized, but in 1986, the Eighth Circuit recognized that the FBI engaged in misconduct. And when someone is put in prison based on government misconduct, it's something that should bother all of us, because any one of us could end up in this Kafkaesque world, and it's a clear invasion of our rights, and that's why this case is extremely important. It also is important because it reflects what I believe is happening to many Native Americans today. I'm not trying to be flip when I say that the prison system is probably the largest Indian reservation in this country, that many young Native Americans are being railroaded and put in prison. And in many instances, just like Leonard, they're being railroaded through government misconduct. And that's why I feel this is an important case. And as a lawyer, what got me very involved in this case is when I started reading and learning about it more in depth, I was embarrassed when the government hides evidence which will undercut the linchpin of their case, and then that evidence is found out, and the man still stays in prison. To me, that's outrageous. And all we're asking for is that he receive a fair trial and be treated fairly. But that's not happening, and in fact, the FBI has gone out of its way to make sure Leonard stays in prison. During the last months of the Clinton administration, Leonard was seeking clemency, and the FBI, in an unprecedented move, took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal and marched on the White House in order to prevent Leonard from getting clemency.
Why are they so vehement about keeping him in prison when they themselves admit that they don't know who killed the two FBI agents that day? I don't understand why they would rally.
I don't understand it either, and I guess you'd have to ask them, because it's...
It must be a political... I mean, what's the politics surrounding it?
Yeah, I mean, Amnesty International has indicated that Leonard Peltier is a political prisoner, and there is a lot of politics surrounding his imprisonment. And at this point, it just seems extreme vindictiveness and overkill to take the positions they're taking, particularly in light of during that whole history. If you look back at that history, the FBI was engaged in a war in the American Indian movement, and Leonard appears to, you know, was basically someone they got in prison. They got him in prison through misconduct, and you know, for them to admit that that's the case, I suppose one could assume that they just don't want to admit their wrongdoing.
If he had a new trial, would a lot come to light? I mean, for example, right now the FBI is still withholding 140,000 documents that you can't access, that he can't access. Would they have to reveal those if they had a new trial? Are they trying to hide something?
They'd certainly have to reveal them. One category of key documents that are being withheld are informant documents. And we, through some of the documents we have a strong suspicion that Leonard's defense team was infiltrated. But that was one document, and they're staunchly refusing to produce even though this is 30 cases, 30 years old, they're refusing to produce any documents that involve the informants, which I think would be very telling. And the fact that the government, and let me give you a little bit of history on this, at Leonard's original trial, they produced 3,500 documents and said that's all they had. After the trial, Leonard's defense team discovered that the FBI had another 18,000 documents, 12,000 of which they produced, 6,000 they withheld under various exemptions. And starting in 1999 and 2000, mainly through the work of Mike Kuzma, who is co-counsel and works with me, and has been dogged in pushing to make sure the government produces all the documents, we found out that there's approximately 140,000 documents which weren't produced. 90,000 of those documents alone were in the Minneapolis field office. And we have a case pending in Minneapolis, and the government has been ordered to produce the documents, but they're producing them in a slow, trickling fashion and refuse to produce certain documents, such as those concerning informants. We also have a case pending in Buffalo, New York, where the government is fighting the production of all the documents. And this is 30 years after the fact, where typically documents 25 years after the fact are considered historical records. And in fact, we were able, through Barney Frank's congressman from Massachusetts, able about 3 years ago to get 30,000 documents released, which were, because they were historical records, but at that point we didn't know how many more the government had, and it shocked us to know that they're withholding so many.
Barry, I'm wondering what you think are the most important basic facts for people to understand, to explain this case to other people. And also, I want to remind people the website again is leonardpeltier.org. I said earlier .com. It's actually leonardpeltier.org.
I think as American citizens, we should never tolerate government misconduct. And this case is fraught with government misconduct. If you go to Leonard's extradition, the only reason he was extradited from Canada to this country is because the United States attorneys, together with a Canadian prosecutor, manufactured affidavits by the name of a woman, Myrtle Poorbear. She gave three affidavits which were internally inconsistent and which were pure lies. They've admitted they were lies. In fact, before the Eighth Circuit...
Can I jump in 1 second, Barry?
Yep.
Myrtle Poorbear, when she gave those inconsistent affidavits, my understanding is the reason that she did was that she was threatened. She was told that the same thing might happen to her that happened to Anna Mae Aquash.
Right. What happened was she first gave an affidavit that said she was Leonard's girlfriend. She wasn't present at the Jumping Bull property, but Leonard escaped and admitted to her that he killed the agents. The Canadian prosecutor met with the United States prosecutors and told them that would not be sufficient. So Myrtle Poorbear was then taken back into custody, held, and shown that if we, for those who know about the Anna Mae Aquash, where the FBI, in an unprecedented action, cut off her arms.
After she had been killed.
After she had been dead and found.
She was an activist on the same reservation, right?
She was an American Indian Movement activist who had been present on the reservation, correct.
And she was found in a shallow grave, killed execution style, right?
She was found off a bluff. It wasn't a shallow grave. She had been murdered, and she was found dead. That's the subject of. That's a whole other show you could do.
But then the FBI, I'm just trying to explain, that was they cut her hands off and sent them to Washington, D.C. after they found her body.
Correct, which Norm Zagrossi on a documentary indicated was unusual behavior.
And they told Myrtle Poorbear, who
they
got...
And they showed pictures of Anime's cut-off hands to Myrtle Poorbear and told her that... she'd suffer a worse fate if she didn't cooperate, at which point she then gave affidavits that said she was Leonard's girlfriend and that she was present at the Jumping Bull property and that she witnessed Leonard kill the agents.
And isn't it true that Myrtle Poorbear also had some mental challenges? She was...
Yes.
What was her situation?
Well... She's mentally, one could say she's not particularly mentally, I wouldn't say she's necessarily incompetent, but she's certainly not particularly, she certainly wasn't able to stand up to the FBI, and they apparently used her in other cases also to create false affidavits to imprison people.
So you could say it's possible they preyed upon this woman to use her for...
I think that you said it much better than I did.
So in any case, they used these three inconsistent affidavits. They put pressure on her, and they ultimately used these things to extradite...
They used two out of the three because the first one...
Said she wasn't present at the Jumping Bull property.
Right.
And that wasn't good enough. They had to get something out of her that said she was there. Then they used that to extradite him from Canada?
That's essentially, if you look at the extradition record, that was, because of the treaty between the United States and Canada, they had to show a prima facie case that Leonard was guilty. And in order to do that, if anyone studies this, regardless of what the government may say, the only real evidence that they had that could support an extradition was her affidavits.
So that's one problem. What are some of the other issues that people should understand?
Well, the other issues are that the government intentionally withheld, as the Tenth Circuit recently stated, intentionally withheld evidence from Leonard's defense team, which would have undercut the evidence that the government put in at Leonard's trial that Leonard wielded the AR-15, which was the murder weapon, and that there was a link between that murder weapon and I analogize to the magic bullet theory in the Kennedy assassination, the casing that was found in Agent Kohler's car. And the government intentionally withheld evidence that showed the government at Leonard's first trial indicated that because the gun had been damaged, an exact test couldn't be done on it, but that the test they did showed that there was a link. What the government intentionally withheld was that the government had indeed done the more exact test on it and showed that there was no link between that casing and that the so-called murder weapon.
And that was the linchpin of their case, was it not?
That was the linchpin of their case.
So that there alone is enough that they shouldn't be in prison.
Correct. And then when it came up to the Eighth Circuit on Leonard's habeas seeking a new trial, the court acknowledged that it was the linchpin, but then applied the wrong standard to the new trial and ended up concluding that, yes, that evidence may have caused serious doubts in the mind of the jury, but that's not enough to give a new trial. Now, I was brought up thinking that you had to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and if this evidence could have caused serious doubt in the jury's mind, Leonard should have been given a new trial. But the court misapplied the standard for what one can say intentionally or unintentionally, in that case, acknowledged the government misconduct, and yet Leonard didn't get a new trial, and he still remains in prison.
So I want to remind people, you're listening to 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with Barry Bachrach. He's lead counsel for Leonard Peltier and has been for the last 4 years. I just want to, if you could, let people know again what the current situation is and what they can do about it. Leonard Peltier was just moved from Leavenworth to Terre Haute. His family was not notified, nor were you. They found out because his grandson went to visit him, and they just simply said he's not here. He is in solitary confinement at Terre Haute and has not been treated very well. I'm wondering, again, what people can do. You're asking people to contact the prison, is that?
And the Bureau of Prisons, and in fact, on the website, there's a standard letter that people can look at and write. In fact, you'd ask me how Leonard was doing. He wasn't given his medication for a few days and was only getting it after I spoke to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that people get involved in this aspect, and they should also learn more and get involved in Leonard's case in general. There's many ways people can get involved, and they can contact the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, or you can give them my email address, because it's extremely important that justice finally be given, because until justice is given in this case, it's just a travesty.
And your email?
bbachrach@bowditch.com.
So bbachrach@bowditch.com?
Correct.
And the website again is leonardpeltier.org. Thanks so much for joining me today, Barry. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and Leonard very much appreciates all the support that you give him, and like I say, just winding up, this is a 30-year-old case, but it's indicative of what could happen to any of us if we just remain complacent.
Thank you so much, Barry.
Thank you.
And good
luck.
Take care. Thanks for your work.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. That, again, was Barry Bachrach. He's the lead counsel for Leonard Peltier. He has been for the last 4 years. His email address is bbachrach@bowditch.com. That's spelled bbachrach@bowditch.com. bbachrach@bowditch.com. You can also go to leonardpeltier.org. And I want to let you know that Leonard Peltier is also an artist and a writer. He's a painter whose paintings, beautiful paintings, have appeared in art galleries and art museums. I went to see a showing of his work in San Francisco a few years ago, and it was absolutely beautiful. He's also written a book called Prison Writings, My Life is My Sundance. It's an excellent book. He's also a great grandfather and an indigenous rights activist and a citizen of the Anishinaabe and Dakota Lakota Nations. He's been in prison since 1976. He was imprisoned at the U.S. Penitentiary in Leavenworth, Kansas, but was just recently moved to Terre Haute, as I mentioned, without notifying his family or attorney. On Friday, he was moved, and his supporters at the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee and his attorney, as you just heard, are asking people to contact the Bureau of Prisons, and the information is at leonardpeltier.org. His name is spelled P-E-L-T-I-E-R. You can read all about him, his case, his art, his book, and He's also a Nobel Peace Prize candidate. You can read about his human rights achievements. And you can contact him as well and the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee by going to their website, leonardpeltier.org. Thanks so much for listening.